If the state cannot place fentanyl in the hands of Corey Richens, the state has no case. That is the line defense attorney Catherine Nestor dropped like a grenade into the middle of one of Utah's highest profile impending murder cases, and it might just change everything. Corey Richens is the Park City mom accused of killing her husband, Eric Richens, with five times the lethal dose of fentanyl, and she could now be on the verge of possibly seeing freedom. Is that even remotely a chance? Before trial, all because the prosecution star witness has just flipped the script and changed his story.
Welcome to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime. Here's your host, Emmy Award-winning journalist, Joel Waldman.
What's up, SDS Nation? Welcome to Surviving the Survivor. It is the show that brings you the very best guests in all of true crime. Corey Richens, we've heard her name floated around for the better part of 2 years. She is the Utah mother of three, a self-published author of a children's book titled Are You With Me? She even had the chutzpah to go on a Salt Lake City AM morning show to talk about this book after the death of her husband, of which she is accused of. Prosecutors are convinced that she poisoned her 39-year-old husband in March of 2022 to collect nearly $2 million in life insurance payouts. The state's theory, Corey obtained this fentanyl from her housekeeper, a woman named Carmen Lauber, who in turn got the pills from a man named Robert Crozier. For full disclosure, from second grade on, one of my best friends in the world is Robert Crozier, but not this Robert Crozier. So I sent Robert Crozier this article and he was stunned. But how many Robert Croziers are there out there? Not a lot. One of them, my good friend. Eric died in bed after Corey's real estate deal went through. It was this $2 million mansion that she was in the process, I guess, of flipping here. So five times the lethal dose of fentanyl, and here to help us break this down and what it means is host of Courtroom Confidential. There he is, a former LA prosecutor of the year, criminal defense attorney, and my good friend, Josh Ritter. The two of us, I never, ever complain to Josh about what I'm doing because I absolutely love it. And it never, ever tires me out. I'm always full of energy. Josh Ritter, this is interesting. This is a case that got continued. I was supposed to go out, I think, this past April to cover this in the Park City, Utah area. And then lo and behold, the defense asked for more time. And people were wondering what was going on, what's happening. And now suddenly this guy at the center of this case, this guy named Robert Crozier, which is so weird to me because he literally is one of my best friends in real life, not this guy. He allegedly told detectives back in 2023 that he had sold this fentanyl to Carmen Lauber, who is the one-time housekeeper for the Richens. And then Corey passed that on. Carmen Lauber passed on to Corey, who then in turn poisoned her husband. But now the whole backbone to the story has literally just snapped because in an April 2025 interview with Summit County prosecutors up there in Park City, this guy, Rob Crozier, said that he never sold fentanyl, but it was only OxyContin, and he doesn't ever remember saying otherwise. Weird twist, unexpected twist from a legal perspective. How big a deal is this?
It's a big deal, but it might not be a big deal for what people are thinking initially. And I'll explain. But first of all, my condolences to your friend, Robert Crozier, because yeah. I fear now that if anybody ever Googles him, he might not get hired for that next job if anybody tries to vet him.
The funny thing about my Rob Crozier is he is a PhD in neuroscience. He's actually at a conference I just texted him. He's at a conference in Vienna, and I don't know. It's
Now everybody in Vienna is wondering why this drug dealer is speaking to them at this convention.
Yeah.
So it is a problem. Obviously, it's a problem for the prosecution whenever you have your quote unquote star witness recanting. And your star witness, first of all, started out with problems because they're a drug dealer. And it sounds like he's got drug problems of his own because he was quote unquote out of it and detoxing at the time that he gave the initial interview to investigators. That was how they started to link this whole case together. And now he's saying, yeah, I dealt drugs, but I didn't even deal in fentanyl at the time. And I was only dealing in OxyContin. And I don't remember saying anything about fentanyl. It's a problem. Will it be enough of a problem to turn the case upside down? I don't think so. And I'll tell you more about that. But where I see the bigger problem is in the fact that the prosecution interviewed this man again in April and didn't turn that over to the defense. The only reason the defense found out about his recanting is they interviewed him. And during their interview, he says, I've talked to the prosecution about this back in April, and I told them I didn't sell fentanyl. And now they're saying, well, wait a second, where's the report from the prosecution? You read an excellent quote there to start the show from Corey Richin's attorneys talking about how, you know, how can they even proceed on this case? Well, they go on to say, where was the press conference? Where was the report? Where was anything? The prosecution just kept quiet. That's a major problem for the prosecution as a prosecutor. And this is a reason why prosecutors oftentimes will not re-interview witnesses, is because every time you interview them, you're supposed to create a report. Mm-hmm. Even if there's nothing really new that comes out of that, the defense is entitled to know that you spoke to this person again. And the fact that they spoke to them, didn't create a report, got new or different information, and didn't immediately turn that over is going to be a major problem. Now, it's going to come down to how will the judge handle it? What remedy does the judge see for all of this? But end of the day, it's beneficial to the defense because now the prosecution star witness, who knows what to believe about this guy and who knows how reliable he in fact might be.
And this has got to be an intentional omission on the part of the government, right? Because this is a big, I mean, in terms of like the fact-based evidence in the case, when they hear now their quote unquote star witness saying, no, it wasn't fentanyl, it was OxyContin, and I was coming off, he claims he was in detox when he was interviewed the first time, and then to tell prosecutors, no, it was OxyContin. I mean, that's not like a little thing. No. where the government can argue to your honor that, oh, you know, we just forgot to include this in the report. That's a very clear omission of a pretty big now bad fact for the government in this case. So what kind of leeway does the judge have here, I guess, at the next hearing to either admonish the government or whatever else a judge might do to the government?
No, it's not a small thing. That's an excellent point. And it's not a decision for the prosecution to be making. Even if they did say, well, hey, we're not really, it's not a big deal to us, fentanyl, OxyContin, whatever. We just know that he was selling these drugs and that he happened to sell them to this woman, Karen Lauber. And that's really the point. They don't get to decide, though, what's important for the defense. Maybe it's very important to the defense that he wasn't selling fentanyl and he was only selling OxyContin. And I agree with you. I think that's an important part of this entire case. But they don't get to decide that. They're just supposed to create the report and hand it over, even if, like I said, there's no new information in it. But what does the judge do now? Well, the judge has to look for a remedy here. The remedy can be as bad as exclusion, meaning that witness doesn't get to testify at all. Now, is that beneficial to the defense? And will the judge go that far? I don't know if the judge would go that far to actually exclude a witness based upon this. It's essentially a discovery violation. He might, but again, when you think about it, this new information is helpful to the defense. So how much do they want it excluded? Like, unless he's going to kick out that witness entirely, I would imagine the defense would say, well, listen, we want this new information to be a part of the trial because the new information impeaches his prior information. So it puts the judge in a rough spot because it is, in my view, a clear violation by the prosecution. But you bring up an excellent point on, is it intentional? That brings us into an entirely different arena. If it's intentional, if the prosecution actually buried this because they felt that it was hurtful to them, now we are looking at very serious violations that could lead to something as impactful as the judge starting to maybe tear apart their case. I mean, that is just misconduct on another level if they're burying information. I hope it was just some sort of reckless oversight.
Yeah. So it's not, at least not yet. We're not at a place where charges might be dropped against Corey Richens and she just walks free. That's not happening yet.
I think that would be unless we start to find out that this is some sort of pattern of conduct by the prosecution of burying information. I don't think the judge is going to toss the case entirely. But he could go as far as removing important parts of their case. I mean, if this Robert Crozier is as crucial to their case as he sounds like he is, if the judge says, I'm not going to allow that person to testify because you've been burying evidence, that could be really impactful. But the argument being made by the defense, at least at this point, that, hey, without the fentanyl, there is no case. The judge isn't going to make that call now. The judge is going to say, I think what the judge will do is say, you can use this all for impeachment. I will allow you to bring up to the jury that there was some sort of late discovery violation in this case, but it's up to the jury to decide whether or not it's important that this man remembers he was selling fentanyl or not, or what condition he was in at the time that he first spoke to police.
Have you ever seen either a state star witness become a defense witness or vice versa? Does that happen?
Sure.
Because to your point, like, if I'm the defense, I now want it, you obviously know the law. I don't, but playing one on TV, I would want this guy to testify for me if I'm the defense, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the defense is going to have a field day with this guy, even if things remain as they are, even if the judge doesn't do anything and he just says, I'm going to allow the jury to kind of sort this all out. As the defense, you'll have a field day with this guy. You've got him saying one thing on one date. Now you've got him sometime later saying something completely the opposite of that and admitting at the time that he gave his initial interview that he was, detoxing and out of it and can't remember even what he was saying. He's a worthless witness. Even if he does testify, he starts to become a worthless witness for the prosecution. And if he is the centerpiece of this prosecution, well, then if so goes your star witness, so goes the rest of your case. It could be a major problem.
Yeah. So the attorney at the center of all this, not for the government, but for the defense, is a woman named Catherine Nestor. She's a veteran Utah defense lawyer who also happens to be representing Tyler Robinson. He is the 22-year-old charged with the assassination of Charlie Kirk. And so it's this woman, Catherine Nestor, who filed this really fiery motion accusing prosecutors of withholding this exculpatory evidence. And Nestor in her filing wrote, this was not an oversight. It is rot at the core, poisoning the whole harvest of justice. And she goes on, essentially, well, she's arguing the state cannot show fentanyl ever passed. It's a chain of custody issue here, essentially, Josh, that the state cannot show that fentanyl ever passed from this guy, Rob Crozier, to the housekeeper, Carmen Lauber, to then Corey Richens, if he was never giving it to her in the first place. So she again claims, this is Catherine Nestor, the attorney for Corey Richens, that the chain of evidence does collapse, and goes on to write in this filing, Mr. Crozier's statement doesn't just poke holes in their case, it throws a grenade in the middle of it. So again, I mean, Josh, to your point a second ago, no matter which way this goes right now, they're going to make a big deal about this witness to show that there's a lot of doubt, a lot of reasonable doubt as to Corey Richens ever even be able to obtain fentanyl if this guy who is the dealer says he never gave it to the person she got it from.
Yeah, it's a bad problem for the prosecution, but I think it's going to be a bad problem that we will see manifest itself at trial. I don't think it's going to be something that the judge will right now make a decision to take this out of the hands of the jury because of this, as you described it well, as a chain of custody issue. I mean, the judge's only determination already passed when we went through the preliminary hearing and he took a look at the evidence and decided, is there probable cause to hold her to answer for trial? I don't believe that his decision in that situation was based entirely just on this witness saying I gave fentanyl to another person who then sold it to Corey. There was other circumstantial evidence at play. I mean, she's got a huge financial interest in this murder. So there's plenty enough evidence to get this to trial. But at trial, now we're talking about throwing hand grenades in the middle of your trial. I mean, if you're going to try to explain this to the jury as this case hinges upon the idea that we can prove fentanyl was placed in Corey Richens' hands before her husband died, and then you've got major problems proving that, yes, you've got very good arguments for reasonable doubt.
Yeah. Now, this case is like many of the ones that we cover, Josh, is really like layered and textured. So this wasn't when he dies, this was not the first poisoning attempt. She actually tried poisoning him, and there's evidence of this back on the previous Valentine's Day, prior Valentine's Day to his death. So again, to your point, and then there's letters that she wrote, the so-called walk the dog letter in jail, which is basically giving an alibi to her brother and essentially mother of what to say. I mean, there's plenty of things and there's plenty of evidence that points to potentially her guilt. So it's not all necessarily hinging on this one guy. I mean, there are other things here that point to her not being, you know, the most saintly woman in the world.
Yeah, and that's why I think the judge is not going to end the case here. I mean, like I said, the judge's decision at this point is there a discovery violation and how do I remedy that discovery violation? But as far as like making the decision on whether or not there's a prosecutable case, that's not in the judge's hands and he's not going to make that decision. He could go as far as excluding certain evidence or excluding certain witnesses that will harm their case, but this case will, you know, unless it somehow settles, it's going to go in front of a jury. It just is a question of how does that look when it goes in front of the jury. I will say this, though, the reaction from the defense has got a lot of flowery language and it's very vociferous. And a lot of that I get a kick out of and I appreciate it. But if I were the defense and I found this out, I would be losing my mind, too. I mean, if I, you know, she says it's rot that goes to the very core of the entire orchard or whatever, however she put it. But it is really bad. I mean, you know, as the defense, you're kind of behind the eight ball all the time. You're constantly trying to play catch up. And then when you feel that it's not a fair matchup, they're not turning over everything, they're perhaps hiding things or whatever, however they're going to characterize this, forgetting to turn it over or not feeling it's important enough to turn it over, it's very frustrating and it puts the defense at a big disadvantage. Think about the Alec Baldwin case, if you want to know how bad these things could get. We're essentially talking about a very similar situation. In that case, somebody came forward to law enforcement and had some evidence, and the prosecution decided this wasn't important enough to compile a report and turn that over to the defense. And when that was discovered in the middle of trial, that judge felt that that discovery violation was bad enough to end the trial right then and there. And that's essentially the same kind of issue we're talking about here.
Yeah. It's fascinating. So we've heard the term, Brady violation. What is a Brady violation? You know, it doesn't have to be super technical, Josh, but and does this rise to the level of a Brady violation?
The concept of Brady stands for the idea that all exculpatory evidence should be turned over to the defense. And that can include things like police misconduct. If you know that the officer had done something in another case unrelated, there was a complaint about that officer's integrity, their honesty, whatever, that is something that should be turned over to the defense. Anything that the defense might be able to use that's exculpatory or impeachment grounds for some sort of impeachment of a witness should be turned over. Where things get murky is when the prosecution tries to decide what those things are and what they aren't. The prosecution should always just be a steward of the evidence and not a gatekeeper of the evidence for the defense. They don't know what the defense's theories are. They don't know how important some evidence might be to the defense or not. But when you've got prosecutors deciding themselves what's important in a case and what's not, and therefore deciding what to turn over, then you run into real problems because the defense, and that's why you see these cases now where defense attorneys are saying, yeah, you turned over the text messages, but I want the phone. I want the phone to do my own data dump, to find my own metadata that might be attached to that, because I don't trust that you're looking for the same things that I'm looking for. And what might not be important to you might be important to me. And I am the defense attorney. I need to decide what is and what is not important to my theory of the case.
So this leads me to my next question, which is, one of the things that the defense, or at least Corey Richens, would like now is some sort of bail option to get her out of jail ahead of the trial, which is coming up, I believe, in February. But still, any time out of jail is a good time, I think. What are the chances now that this judge does grant bail in light of what just transpired?
The only opportunity to revisit the issue of bail would be if the judge considers this new evidence to be a quote unquote change in circumstances. Now, a change in circumstances can be something like counts being dismissed, or it can be, I suppose you could make an argument that a witness, had the judge known, let's say, hypothetically, had the judge known about this information about this witness at the time of the prelim, might the judge have felt differently about the strength of the case and therefore evaluated her bail differently? You could make that argument. I don't know if this will rise to the level of a changed circumstance for the judge to take another look. I will tell you, I'm kind of surprised that she hasn't been given some sort of opportunity at bail. I know it's a first degree murder case. I know it's a case where they're alleging that she had tried to do it, tried to kill him before. Those are all really bad. There's financial crimes involved. All of that stuff's awful. But even in murder cases, people usually get bail. It may be very high bail, but they're at least given that opportunity. The idea that he's holding her with no bail, no opportunity, is kind of shocking to me.
Interesting. I mean, like in Los Angeles County on a first degree murder, what's the bail on a case like that?
$1 million.
Yeah. And you have to put 10% down.
You gotta find a bail agent. You gotta put probably around 10% down. And you know, even more serious cases, you could get bail set by the judge up into, you know, the millions, but it's still an opportunity. If you have a way of piecing together that premium to a bond agent and they're willing to put up that bond, you can get out. It's only in the rarest of cases where you're looking at, you know, life without parole, first degree with special circumstances type murder, that you would be denied bail altogether. And you have to have even a special hearing for that. It's a big deal to deny a person the opportunity even for bail. So I you know, again, I'm not an expert on Utah law, but I'm just shocked that they haven't set any kind of bail for her.
It's funny. I'm a big fight fan. I think you know that. I'm not bare knuckle fighting is one of the organizations. It's a little too violent for me. tough to watch. But one of the fighters this past weekend I saw on Twitter, I think this was a first, was fighting with an ankle monitor on. So he was out on bail. Had his ankle monitor. You can see it through his white sock on his boxing shoes. So there you go. Corey could be making, she could be back at Home Depot making a few extra bucks if she got bail. How about capitalizing as a defense attorney, as Catherine Nestor, kind of leaning in on this and putting pressure on the government for, forget the bail, but on some sort of plea deal or reduction of a possible sentence. You know, there's obviously gamesmanship involved, you know, the flowery language you talked about. There's got to be concern that there's still a lot of bad facts that she's got to deal with, Corey Richens. And maybe here's an opportunity to get, you know, 8 to 15 years or something instead of a life sentence in the state of Utah. Is now a time or an opportunity to go for something like that? Or is that just a moot point?
No, I think that, you know, depending on how the judge comes out on this, if the judge does do something to damage the strength of the prosecution's case, you can always revisit plea negotiations, because the prosecution's worried, you know, I mean, even without the judge doing anything, I think the prosecution's a little more worried about the strength of their case. Anyways, you've got your, you know, one of your pivotal witnesses who's now recanting. Imagine what a absolute mess this is going to be come to trial. And they might be thinking, hey, you know, juries sometimes do crazy things. And what if we get a, you know, what if we get a couple of jurors that might buy this and we get a hung jury, or worse yet, we get an acquittal. So they might be more inclined to revisit that. My concern for the defense is that it probably is not going to be anything that she would be able to live with anyways. I mean, yeah, they might remove life without parole, but it's probably still going to be in the neighborhood of, you know, 25, 50 years to life. And she probably is thinking, I'd rather take my chances anyways.
Yeah. It seems like people look at Sarah Boone. She had a plea deal and rolled the dice, and she's stuck in prison for the rest of her life. By the way, if you appreciate having the great Josh Ritter, host of Courtroom Confidential, on the show, please hit that like and subscribe button and drop us a comment. We're not live today because my three little ones are still home because of the Jewish holidays. And I am just trying to keep my head above water. We're headed over to Carm's for a little holiday meal tonight. But let me know what you think of these types of shows that are recorded. Obviously, you don't get the chance, the opportunity to ask questions in a live chat, but it is a different way to provide content. So let us know what you think here. So a few more questions and then we'll let Josh go on his merry way. But now, from a prosecutor's perspective, and you've been on both sides of the proverbial legal aisle, Josh, what is your strategy now, aside from, you know, bending your knee to your honor and letting them know that it was just a mistake of yours and nothing intentional? But what happens now? They might not have this quote unquote chain of custody that shows movement of fentanyl from this guy, from the dealer, Rob Crozier, to Carmen Lauber, to Corey Richens. So, I mean, how do you keep your case afloat if there's no way for you to introduce fentanyl into Corey Richens' hands? Like, if there's no way for you to show that she got it, is that a big problem? Or can the jury just infer that she got it a different way, I guess?
I think, listen, anytime you can actually, like you said, show some sort of chain of custody to explain how she got her hands on it, it's going to make your case stronger. But I think their case is probably much more of a multi-layer tapestry of circumstantial evidence. I mean, you pointed out some of these things, the walk the dog letter, her financial interests, the fact that he had even complained to someone ahead of time that he thought his wife might be trying to kill him, you know, that he felt poisoned on a prior occasion. They've got some, you know, they recovered a journal from her home that has got some interesting evidence inside of it. They've got a lot to work with here. And honestly, They probably knew going in with this Robert Crozier that he was not going to be the greatest witness. His importance lies in what role he played, but as a testifying person, they were probably not very hopeful because he is, you know, a person with his own criminal issues, legal problems. He was apparently an abuser himself at one point. I, as a prosecutor, many times you've got your witnesses have all sorts of problems, and you got to deal with it, and you got to be upfront with the jurors ahead of time and explain that listen, they're going to be hearing from people who aren't exactly saints, but they've got important things to tell. I don't think it entirely is wiping out the prosecution's case. One other thing, though, to think about is judges, they can lose patience. And if the judge feels that this is some sort of pattern behavior on the part of the prosecution, that this wasn't just some sort of one-off mistake, and that there is a pattern of kind of hiding the ball and playing fast and loose with discovery rules, that's going to bleed over into other things. That's going to bleed over into evidentiary calls that the judge makes, issues that might arise during trial. You never want to get on the bad side of a judge that the judge feels that you're playing dirty.
Yeah, those are excellent points. I mean, just in the recent Adelson coverage, you saw the judge getting incredibly frustrated with Donna Adelson's inability to let him know if she was going to testify. And finally, at one point, he threatened contempt, and that prompted the answer there. Going back to your flowery and vociferous language, I like that word. Nestor, in her filing, Catherine Nestor, the criminal defense attorney, says, this was not an oversight again, but, and I quote here, rot at the core, poisoning the whole harvest of justice. When lawyers start to write in that flowery kind of way, is it for the judge or is it more for the court of public opinion? Why are they writing in that style?
They lack good editors. honestly, it's not getting anywhere with the judge. But this is a high profile case. They're probably, I think Catherine Nestor's fairly media savvy. I think she knows that when she files something like this, it's going to have things that are picked up by the media and quoted. And she probably wanted to leave them some good nuggets in there. But honestly, I think as far as persuasiveness to a judge, it's not getting you anywhere. I enjoy it. I think it's funny, but I don't think it's getting anywhere with the judge.
I mean, and last, and I don't want to be crass here, but I mean, isn't the government's, I guess, best piece, and again, it's going to sound crass, but I don't mean it to sound this way, but I mean, sort of one of their best bad facts and best piece of evidence is the fact that there was this prior poisoning attempt and then the husband ends up dead. I mean, this guy, Eric Richens, is no longer with us. He's got three young children. At one point, the Eric Richens' sister literally gets into a fight with Corey Richens. It's not like you eliminate this witness and everything just falls away into the ether. There's plenty of smoke around this woman, Corey Richens. But does it mean you're now going from sort of a direct evidence case to a circumstance? We see circumstantial cases win all the time. But, just back to this point, isn't Eric Richens' death just such a strong piece of evidence or a bad fact against Corey Richens to begin with, I guess?
You remember when this case, when he first died, initially, she was not a suspect at all. They felt it was some sort of, at first they didn't know. I mean, they thought, he just kind of dropped dead for no reason. And then they thought, they realized that he was a kind of a casual drug user himself, and that maybe he got a bad batch of something. I think that was a theory at play for a little while. Yeah. And then it wasn't until they started to really look into her financial issues and her conduct directly after. Remember, she was like trying to get into his safe and get on her hands on some financial documents within days of him dying. That really, I think, started to turn the police investigation towards looking at her as a serious suspect. But that idea of fentanyl being an epidemic in this country and that people die of fentanyl all the time and it's not murder is always going to be part of the defense theory in this case. They're going to say that this is an unfortunate tragedy and that he took a bad dose of something because he would recreationally use drugs himself and he happened to drop dead and it's a tragedy. And now they're trying to blame this all on her. The idea that he perhaps was poisoned before by her changes all of that. Now we've got, no, this is not some accident. This is premeditated. She had tried it once before. It didn't work. She went back and tried it again. Now the conversations that she's having with people about get me the stuff that Michael Jackson used and the drug dealing and all of that take on a much more sinister light. You realize, you know, that this was not a man who was unfortunately overdosed on his own, but that she was, you know, planning his murder.
Yeah. Final question for you. So this woman, Catherine Nestor, interesting, you know, figure, obviously a high powered criminal defense attorney out of the great state of Utah. And she's handling the Charlie Kirk assassins case as well. Is that too much to take on at one time? I mean, I feel like if I were Corey Richens, I'd be saying to myself, this is, you know, Charlie Kirk's about as high profile a case as you can get. She's handling the alleged assassin in that case. It seems like a lot for one criminal defense attorney to be handling simultaneously. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, her dance card is filling up. I will say a couple of things I think are happening here. One, Tyler Robinson for the assassination of Charlie Kirk, that is not going to move quickly at all. I don't think we're going to be looking at trial on that thing until maybe late next year or more, because it is a death penalty case and because there is, even according to the prosecution, a voluminous amount of discovery. It's just going to take a long time. If we all remember, Brian Koberger took years to get to trial, and that was in large part because the death penalty was on the table. So Corey's case is going to be handled much sooner than all of that. But the other thing is that the state of Utah, because they're pursuing the death penalty against Tyler Robinson and because he needed counsel appointed to him, they need a quote unquote death qualified attorney. And she is in Utah, I think, one of just a few and one of just a few willing to take this case, maybe. So it was kind of like out of necessity, I think, in part, that they brought her in. But, you know, there are many attorneys who are handling a big caseload with a lot of high profile stuff on it. You're right. If I'm Corey, though, I'm sure she's had some discussions about you better not be taking anything away from me because I'm fighting for my life just as much as he is to handle that case.
Yeah, by the way, our best guest, one of them, Greg Skordis, he actually represented Tyler Robinson, the alleged assassin, at, I think, his preliminary hearing, and was the spokesperson, still might be, for the Richens family. We'll get Greg back on. He's a great guy, formerly ran for Attorney General of Utah, and he's been a criminal defense attorney in this county where the Corey Richens case is happening for like 40 plus years, maybe 45 years. So great dude. Finally, Josh Ritter, are your Dodgers going to win again? I still don't think I've ever worn my Dodgers jersey. I have a Dodgers shirt. I will wear it the next time. My Yankees only gave up something like, I don't know, 22, 23 runs in their first two games. They're looking absolutely horrendous. Do you have confidence that your Dodgers are going to take a back-to-back title here?
Now we're getting to the hard-hitting issues. Now we're getting to the stuff people want to hear. My Dodgers, I think, and I don't want to say this and jinx them, but they look very good. Yeah. I hope the Yankees, turn it around, because I would love to see a rematch. I think that would be good for baseball, and I think it would. I think a lot of people would be looking forward to that. But they've got some trouble on their hands right now. But the Dodgers are looking again. I feel like the second these words come out of my mouth, the next three games they're going to lose. But they're looking very strong. And yeah, you do owe me. I think what was it? You got to wear a jersey or a hat or something.
Yeah, I have a shirt, but I'll get a jersey. We'll have to get a jersey. I want to do a psychological, like a show with a psychologist about why every sports fan in the world, including myself, thinks that the minute that they speak about their team, that the team is going to lose. Seems a bit egotistical, but I'm the same way. I'm the exact same way. But
well, we all feel that somehow we're responsible for their wins and losses. Some jerk sitting at home watching it somehow plays a crucial role.
On the cap. By the way, if you didn't know, Josh Ritter was a star baseball player at Santa Monica High. He was almost how close were you to becoming a Los Angeles Dodger, Josh?
Oh, Ritter? Very close. I think it was just like a scheduling thing more than anything that it didn't work out.
Would you have taken a career as a right fielder for the Dodgers instead of being an attorney?
Oh, yes. I would do it now. Broken body, I would do it now.
On that note, love you, America. Let's get justice here for Eric Richens. Love you, Utah. We'll be back on the flip side, and have a great night, everybody. Just stick around 1 second.